Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Trimbuckle Turmoil fan, Sign Guy and QT with you here on another Sunday. If you are looking for some wrestling today, KDW running in Jeffersonville, Indiana today. Wrestle Circus in Austin, Texas. And up in our neck of the woods, NWA Blue Collar Wrestling, like usual on a Sunday at the North Portland Eagles. Chris Youngblood returning to the promotion to challenge for the NWA Heritage Heavyweight Championship. So it should be a great time in Portland, Oregon tonight. Without further ado, though, I would like to welcome our guest to the show, someone I've been very excited to have with us on Turnbuckle Turmoil. We have with us Jeff Buchanz. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you on today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
We normally start out with asking the guest how they got into the crazy world of professional wrestling. You not really being in the industry, though, I'll rephrase it. How did you get drawn into the crazy world of professional wrestling?
I grew up in Forest Hills, Queens, in New York City, and I loved wrestling from a very young age, probably around 8 years old. Couldn't get into Madison Square Garden. They had a rule you had to be 14 or over. But there was a little arena called Sunnyside Garden or in Queens Boulevard, and they ran monthly shows on Saturday afternoons, which was just awesome for a young kid. You can go to these shows. You can see the wrestlers come in out of their cars into the arena, the same guys you saw on TV. Very intimate. It was really pretty cool.
How would you say that the Sunnyside Queens shows was something that really hooked you onto the business? Had you followed it on television to get you hooked initially?
For sure. Got hooked on TV, got to see them live. We grew up in the area of Bruno Sammartino, and Bruno would come there maybe once a year or so. So you'd see the next biggest baby face, whether it was Chief J. Strongbow or Victor Rivera or Spiros Arion, and you'd see him against the number one heel who had just lost to Bruno at the Garden or Boston Garden, who was now on the way down in the territory. But it was very cool. I remember my first time to Madison Square Garden, I think I was 13, 12, and my dad took me. It was Bruno Sammartino against Gorilla Monsoon. Big show at the old Garden, so it was before 1968. And we got there and they wouldn't let me in because I was too young and they had to be 14. And I cried the whole way home. I'll never forget it. And my first show getting into the Garden was in 1970. I was 13 years old. It was a month after I got bar mitzvah. That's what happens to Jewish kids at 13. And the match was Bruno Sammartino against Beppo Mongol, who went on to become Nikolai Volkov. So I was 13, but this time I was able to get in. And I distinctly remember the finishing sequence of Bruno and Beppo Mongol running off the ropes before Bruno just did like a power smash slam and pinned him. 1, 2, 3, like it was yesterday. But I don't remember one sentence from my bar mitzvah Haftarah. So wrestling left an impact on my life for sure.
Once you were old enough, were you a regular at the Madison Square Garden shows?
Every month I would go down there. I would go around 6 o'clock to the Madison Square Garden ticket booth. The shows were regularly sold out. There was one bald guy with glasses behind a ticket seller. I'd go up to him about 6:20. He'd wink, and I'd come over. The tickets were $6 or $7. I'd give him a $10 bill, and he'd give me a first-row seat because evidently they had tickets for the wrestlers' families or whatever that they held back, like at a theater, the same thing. And when it was around 6:20, they sent him down to this guy, and he had his regulars and made $3 or $4 per ticket, and I would sit in the first row as a kid. It was really unbelievable.
Now, I know that you eventually started meeting some of the wrestlers and forming relationships with them. Who were some of the first wrestlers that you met that you formed relationships with other than just fan and entertainer?
It happened by accident. In 1978, they had the Super Bowl of Wrestling down at the Miami's Orange Bowl. And it was Harley Race, who was NWA champion at the time, against superstar Billy Graham, who was WWWF champion at the time. So we had intercession in school. In New York, you're off for a week. And I went down there. I suckered one of my buddies to go down with me to Florida for the week. But the whole reason I wanted to go is to see the show. And it was a pretty loaded card. It was, unfortunately, a very rainy night. And the semifinal that night was Dusty Rhodes, who was the big babyface down there, against Ken Patera, who was a big heel up in New York. And they had trouble because the ring was very wet and everything slipping around. And Dusty, as usual, gigged himself and was bleeding. So Patera comes out of the ring with blood all over him. Now, I was in college, and I wanted to become a sports reporter. So I always carried a video cassette recorder to do interviews with people. So Patera comes out with Dusty Rhodes' blood all over him. I turn the recorder on and go, "Hey, Ken, how about a little interview?" He looks at me. He never knew me. I was a kid, 20 years old, whatever. And he goes, "Listen, let me go take a shower. Wait for me, and I'll come back out." I said, "Okay." So about a half hour later, he comes back outside. We wind up going drinking at some bar. This is at the time when Miller Lite came out, and I think I had maybe 15 Miller Lights. I didn't get one inch off the ground because I was so excited. Here, I'm a mark, and I'm with Ken Patera. So we're sitting at this bar. It's now at 2 in the morning. There's a lot of wrestlers coming and going, and all of a sudden, Harley Race comes over to the table. I said, does it get any better than this? So Harley Race sits down and Ken introduces me. I go, "Very nice to meet you. Very nice job. Nice job tonight. I have to say, I enjoyed your performance." And he goes, "Yeah, if the ref had only counted a little faster, I would have had him." So Patera, you know, looked at me and said, "Jeff, professional courtesy, you don't know him, kayfabe, don't say anything." And that was it. That was my first wrestler I ever met, was Ken Patera. We stayed friends. We're still friends to this day, through his thick and thin and everything. We just became lifelong friends, and that of course, led to Maccabiah Mania, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Now, at any time between the 70s and the very late 80s when the landscape changed and Vince McMahon admitted within court in New Jersey that wrestling was predetermined, were you able to speak freely with any of the wrestlers besides Ken Patera? Did they kind of know who you were and know that you could be trusted, or did they still maintain kayfabe with you around?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when Patera came back after his prison stint, he came to the back into the territory, I would always meet him at Newark Airport or wherever hotel they were staying, hang out, have some drinks. And we'd go to the bar and meet Bret Hart or Bobby Heenan or this one or that one. And because they were signaled that I was Patera's friend and it was cool, they were able to break kayfabe with me. The next wrestlers I really met that I got to know, they had something, Halloween Havoc was taking place in Philly at the convention center. It must have been the late 80s somewhere. I don't remember. It was the one where Bruno Sammartino, of all people, was special guest referee for WCW. So that afternoon I went with Patera to Larry Sharp's Monster Factory. I said, "Come on, Ken, let's go. I've never done this. I got to work out once." So I'm having this great summer camp day. First, I go to Larry Sharp's thing. We're working out. They're trying to teach me bumps and whatever, which I couldn't take. And then we go over to the Philly thing. So Ken, of course, walks right into the wrestler's entrance in the back or whatever. You know, I follow him like a little dog. And that was an interesting night because I got to meet Bruno for the first time, which was a childhood, aisle growing up. And Ole Anderson had just been brought back to WCW at the time, and he was sort of like a backstage booker. Not the booker, but like he was an agent running the backstage. So Ken introduced him to me, and somehow Ole Anderson, who trusts no one on this planet, we started hitting it off, and we spent a lot of time during the show talking and everything. I don't know, must have put something he liked. I don't know. This was on a Saturday night. I used to be an investment broker. On Monday morning, Ole Anderson transferred his entire investment portfolio to my firm. It was the most bizarre thing that had ever happened. Ole Anderson, of all people. And I got to know him very well. And it's really very sad that, you know, he came down with MS, I believe. And he told me the story that he didn't drink, he didn't do drugs of any type. He said he wanted to take care of himself because at the end of his life, he didn't want to be a mess. And one of the last times I spoke to him, he said, how ironic that I sacrificed all this stuff to everyone else to do to have a good end of life, and now my end of life is sort of screwy. So that was the next wrestler that I met.
Now, if Ole Anderson trusted you that much that he would invest all of his portfolio with your firm, were there any talks of you taking any type of role with WCW? Did he maybe talk
no.
to some people on your behalf?
No, he when it came to wrestling, he still thought I was an idiot, the same way he thought everyone else was an idiot. No, it was strictly that he trusted me because I came across, I knew what I was doing in my neck of the woods. And in his neck of the woods, he thinks he's the only one that really knows what's going on anyway. So, no, that had no chance. The only chance I ever thought that I might even get a $1 contract with TNA, when they were with Spike TV, the president of Spike TV was a guy named Doug Herzog, who's head of USA Network Comedy Central. And Doug and I were summer camp buddies. So I always used to kid him. I said, Doug, just give me a $1 contract with WCW. So I said I could have it. But you, as a true professional, he wouldn't do it.
Now, when wrestling hit the national wars, so to speak, when it was WCW and the WWF at the time battling it out on cable television and Monday Night Raw came into prominence, were you still a big wrestling fan at that point? Did you still have contact with some of the people within the industry?
I think that was around 93 or so. So at that stage of the game, you know, Patero was my friend and Ole was my friend. And I will tell you a Monday Night Raw story. I'm a big New York Rangers fan. I have season tickets forever. So I went with a few of my buddies. I think the Rangers are playing the Vancouver Canucks that night, the Garden. And I said, fellas, here's what we're doing. In between periods, we're going over to the Manhattan Center, which was like a block and a half away. Let's see if we can get in. I want to see some of this first Raw. So we go running over to the Manhattan Center. And just as we get in the front, they're filming a skit. Well, they're not filming, they're doing a live skit with Bobby Heenan acting as a rabbi trying to get in because he had been kicked out or deprived of a ticket or whatever. And sure enough, I was there right in the center of the picture. So a couple people said, hey, Jeff, we saw you on TV tonight. So, yeah, I was on the very first Raw. If you go to YouTube and go very first Raw and you see the Bobby Heenan skit, I'm the guy with the glasses and the goofy smile right in the middle. That's me.
When you were running to the Manhattan Center and you see a familiar-looking rabbi, did it ever dawn on you that you were witnessing a little bit of history? Because Bobby Heenan doing those skits trying to get into the sold-out Manhattan Center, stuff of legend for fans that were around for the first ever Monday Night Raw.
It was legendary, but at the time, all I could think of is how ridiculous this was that, you know, in between periods of a Ranger game, this is happening. And clearly, you know, it was great shtick with Bobby Heenan. And I did get to meet him a couple of times because he was friends with Patera, who was managing him. I don't remember what it was at the time. And we go to the hotel bar, and some of the stories that he told, I'm not able to tell you on the show, but I will say that he had told some very salty stories.
I definitely believe that coming from Bobby Heenan. Now, you referenced it earlier, of course, and I would like to get into this. Maccabee Mania is something that you were definitely involved in, and it's become legendary in its own right through DVD sales. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
This is crazy. I'm involved with something called Maccabi USA, which they basically have, it's the Jewish Olympics. Every 4 years they have in Israel for Jewish athletes. It's an Olympic-type games. And in 1993, I was in charge of the fencing team, and I had to raise some money to send the fencers over. So I said, raising funds is such a pain in the neck. It's not fun. Let me make it fun. So I said, let me try to live out a fantasy, promote a local wrestling show, do it in the cul-de-sac of the house in the nice neighborhood where I used to live, and just get some old-time wrestlers, and I could just live out the fantasy. So once I got the gleam in my eye, I said, I'm going to do this. I said, I have to have a character. I said, well, I'm the Mighty Maccabee. That's who it's going to be. And now the Mighty Maccabee is going to need some real arch-rival, terrible guy that's against the Jews. So I said, the Iron Sheik, it's the perfect guy. So I said, okay, let's do this. So at that time, I said, all right, I can never do a singles match. My best friend is Ken Patera. It'll be the Mighty Maccabee and his lifelong friend Ken Patera against the Iron Sheik. And I was introduced to Iron Mike Sharp. There was a buddy of mine who promoted in Elizabeth, New Jersey, named Jonathan Gold. And he had access to a lot of the wrestlers because he booked them for personal appearances. So it got Sharp, and it turned out that of all the people we got, the Sheik, of course, is only one of a kind. But Mike Sharp held both of these shows together. He did a great job. So it was a lot of work, I have to say. I wanted to do some old-time stuff, so I got Killer Kowalski, which had to be his last match ever. He was 68 years old. And I got him to wrestle Baron Von Raschke in a Battle of the Claws. And I always loved Von Raschke. I always felt when he came to WWE, he had a very short run. They built him up for 6 weeks. He had one match with Bruno, and he was gone. I don't know what happened there. And I loved his cartoon character. The match was terrible, unfortunately, but I wanted to have that. I also wanted to have a match of Dominic DiNucci against Baron Mikel Cicluna as a rematch from 1967 to Garden, one of the first matches I saw. And that was booked. Unfortunately, Cicluna had called me up one day and canceled because she was upset about something. I don't remember what it was. And some of the undercard, I don't remember. Oh, we had Nikolai Volkov. Oh, Nikolai Volkov against the Iron Sheik would be in a singles match. I had also got to meet Volkov. I forgot about this. I forgot how it happened, but I met Volkov maybe through Jonathan Gold. And actually, I had a WrestleMania party, and he came up. You know, I paid him some money. He came up to be with my friends one time, so he was a good guy. So running the show had a lot of issues because I had to get the town to close off the street, and I had to get the tent, and that it's like throwing a wedding or something. It's a big event, and literally, I mean, I was pulling my hair out. Not to mention that I don't know how to wrestle. I had to go to Iron Mike Sharp's school, so I went down there a couple times, and this is an out of body experience because you know here this is not my element, and I was scared to death that when I went there, you know, some of these big tough truck driver type wrestling guys. I thought one of them was going to potato me or take a shot at me. But the end of the night at Mike Sharp's school, all the guys there would get into what was known as a battle royal, and they would just start doing whatever and throwing everyone out of the ring. So Mike Sharp says, put your mask on. You have to get used to wrestling in the mask, and he puts me in there. And again, I was so scared that someone's going to take a shot at me or throw me over the rope. I didn't know how to do that. But I somehow lived. And we put on the show. It was good because it raised about $20,000. It doesn't matter if the match stunk or not. That wasn't the purpose. My friends came out to see me. I guilted them all to spend $100 to come, and it was a great success. That was the first one. You want me to go the evolution of the second one?
Real quick before you get into the second one, I did have a question on the first one.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned having Kowalski there against Baron Von Raschke in the Battle of the Claws. Going into that match, when you put the match together, obviously they were at an advanced age for wrestling. Was it important for you putting that together for them to have a good match, or did you know going into that the match may not be the greatest, but it was more important just to have the Battle of the Claws just for your own personal satisfaction of seeing it?
The answer is B. This was for my own personal enjoyment and just, you know, to have a little bit of fun. I knew it would be a bad match. But I have to tell you, I forgot about this. In my house, I had a big basement, and that was the dressing room in my fencing room. I had this big, big, long room. So I go down there with little pieces of paper. I said, okay, you go 10 minutes, here's how it ends. You go 12 minutes, here's how it ends. Like I was the booker. Killer Kowalski, when I hand it to him, looks at me, looks down at me, because a big, tall guy goes, I don't read from scripts. I said, oh, I'm really sorry, Mr. Kowalski. You do whatever you want. And at that point, I went over to Patera. I said, you take care of this. I'm out. But I really want to tell you that, forget about the show for a second. It was the night before the show that really was the most ridiculous night I'd ever seen in my life. All these guys are coming in. I'm picking up at the airport. Volkov is driving in. We're going to go out to – they come to my house. We're going to go out to eat dinner at a local Italian restaurant in Livingston, New Jersey, called Nero's. So everyone, you know, Friday night, you want to dress a little, you know, semi-casual. Sheik is wearing his WWE Black Rampage shirt, whatever, you know, you can just imagine. And he's got a little bag with him. I said, Sheiky, you going to go? I said, Jeff, this is the day I want to go. Okay. We walk into the restaurant. In 3 seconds, the Sheik walks over to the bar, and everyone is hugging him and kissing him. He's pulling out pictures and signing work. The Sheik took over the entire restaurant. We ate so much. We drank so much. The stories that they're telling, Von Raschke and Patera, the whole thing is too good to be true for a mark, which is all I am. So about halfway through the dinner, Sheik comes over to me, and he goes, Mr. Jeff, I want you to come with me. I meet big mafia guy from Livingston, and I want to introduce you to him. I said, okay. And I go over and I meet this guy. I go, please, bring your whole family tomorrow. It's on me. Come on up. Around 11:30, we're making so much noise. We're ready to close the restaurant down. We couldn't eat or drink anymore. So, like, we're paying the bill. And all of a sudden, a 22-ounce sirloin steak shows up at the Sheik's. We bring it to the Sheik. I go, Sheiky, what are you doing? You had one of these already. He goes, you are paying, and I'm not done eating. All right, so whatever. We get back to the house, we're trying to calm things down a little bit. And all of a sudden, I had a back staircase in the house that didn't have carpet runners on, so it was probably a little slippery that day because the cleaning girl came on Fridays. All of a sudden, at 2 in the morning, I hear, boom, 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 bang. I go, what the hell is that? I go running up there, and there on the landing of the staircase is Baron Von Raschke with that goofy face, flat on his back, holding a beer, looks up at me, goes, didn't spill a drop. So it was a very crazy night. The boys didn't want to go to sleep because they're night owls. And, Sheiky was doing his thing and the medicine or whatever at 4 in the morning. Finally, my wife came down and says, you guys get the hell into the basement and go to sleep. So I couldn't scare them off. My wife did. That was quite fun.
All right, Al, you referenced the second one. And the second one also kind of legendary with the DVD that was distributed. A lot of people picked that DVD up and enjoyed it, as I did. You want to tell us what went into the second show, which was, I believe, 4 years after the first?
Right. It was for the next Maccabee Games. It's held every 4 years, the year after the Olympic Games. In other words, next year in Israel will be the Maccabee Games, where I'm not in charge of the fencing team. I'm in charge of the entire team. We're sending 1,300 athletes over to Israel. It's twice the size of the U.S. Olympic team. It's quite large. So I said, okay, I did it once. Let's do it again. And this time I told my cousin, Mike Omansky, huge wrestling fan, I said, Mike, this time I want to do a singles match with the Sheik. It's got to be. If I'm going out, I'm going out in flames. And he goes, no, you can't do that. You're not good enough. I said, of course I'm not good enough. So we'll do all the bells and whistles and distractions. We'll figure something out. So this time, I said, let's try to load it up a little bit. We got Jimmy Snuka there, Bam Bam Bigelow. I'll tell you a story about him later. We had the Iron Sheik, of course, against me. Iron Mike Sharp was going to wrestle Kamala, who no-showed, and we actually got King Kong Bundy. Jonathan Gold got King Kong Bundy at 4 in the morning. We really didn't need to because it wasn't like we were false advertising. People were going to pay their money. They were happy. And one of the things I wanted to do, when I was a summer camp counselor at Camp Scatico in upstate New York, one year I was in charge of my group, and you had a camp sing. You take a Billy Joel song and put your words to it, or you take another song. That's whatever everyone did. But we always played Fred Blassie's Pencil Neck Geek. I had the record. We played it all summer. The kids loved it. The kids learned from their counselors, so my kids all love pro wrestling, evidently. I said, geez, Blassie's still alive. Let's get him. So I contact WWE. They told me how much it would cost. They told me you have to have a car bring them out. I sent them the money. I said, okay. So we're going to have Fred Blassie come to the show and sing Pencil Neck Geek. This was strictly for my old summer camp buddies. They said, here we are 20 years later, and here's the real guy singing our song. So it was quite amazing. Now, as far as the match goes, clearly, I don't know how to dance. This is not what I do. So I had to put together a very specific script as to how it's going to go. Patera had it. I FedEx him a copy. I FedEx Mike Sharp a copy. I FedEx the Sheik a copy. And that way everyone was going to be on the same page. Problem is, I don't think the Sheik really reads English. And he couldn't follow the script. So it was really Mike Sharp. If it had not been for him, however bad that match was, would have been much worse if not for Mike Sharp holding it together.
Now, on the second event, of course, we now have the Maccabean World Heavyweight Championship. you went all out with having a championship made. It was a beautiful title belt. Was the world championship something that you envisioned at the time as being something that would be viable for shows in between events? Were you planning to maybe use it on different shows, or was this solely for the Maccabean Mania 2?
It was solely for Maccabean Mania 2. I got this stuff made, adorable Adrian Street. He made my uniform. I think he made the belt as well. That's where I got it from. I said, let's just make it a little bit fun. Now, you said, was it for other shows? As it turned out, people contacted me after this ridiculous second show. Two things. They heard I made money, so they wanted me to promote, which is another meme for being a money mark, which obviously I knew that's not happening. And some people even asked me to do local shows. And I said, no, it's not what I do. So, no, but it was only done for that one show.
Now, of course, Freddie Blassie, like you said, singing Pencil Neck Geek. You also had Nikolai Volkoff performing Hava Nagila and a lot of music there at the second
Karamia.
Show.
Nikolai did Karamia, which was from the wrestling album, which he did great on that wrestling album. Do you remember the wrestling album?
I do.
Yeah, he was great. So I said, all right, let's just not only let's have him lip sync it. Let's have the original thing and have him lip sync it. So the whole thing, this was like a Rocky Horror Show. The whole thing from start to finish was ridiculous. But we had fun. And, the fact that you have to, when you're done asking me those questions, we're going to have to get to how did it even become to the DVD, because that was not the intention.
Now, the second show also featured something that became legendary in its own right. There was an interview that Iron Sheik did that some might have deemed a little bit controversial at the time. When you were preparing to do the interviews, did you have any idea what Iron Sheik was actually going to discuss in that interview?
You know, he said to me, Jeff, what do you want me to say? And I said, Sheik, just do your usual thing, you know, and you can just say whatever you want. You know the theme here, it's a Jewish group or whatever, so you can say whatever the hell you want. And he was so funny. He goes, I come to the New Jersey, the safest country in the world of New Jersey, and all of my intelligent Jew businessmen. I mean, no one was insulted by it. You know, we live in this ridiculous, political, correct world right now. Really, seriously, enough. And no one there was offended. We had a really good time, and we laughed. We knew it was the Sheik, and he could have said a lot worse, and it wouldn't have bothered anybody.
Now, in the match itself, obviously you weren't exactly a trained professional wrestler. Chairs were involved. Some throws to the floor were involved in that match. Going into it, did you feel like you were prepared as well as you could be to do the match, or were you a little bit nervous about the physicality aspect of it going into it?
I was a little nervous because the Sheik goes, Jeff, you want me to give you the suplex? And I go, no, Kazuro, no suplex. I don't know how to fall. I'm not going to fall. We'll do what we're going to do. And I really wasn't too nervous about it because for the months leading up to it, you know, I was going over this in my brain over and over and over again. So if a monkey wrench was thrown into the equation, which it was early, the Sheik, you know, went off the script, I could be in trouble. But I knew what the progression of the match was going to be, and I felt comfortable with it. And trust me when I tell you that at the first one, Mike Sharp hit me so hard with that forearm. It was on if you look at Brian Zane's Wrestling with Regret thing, the first one, it was this one shot where I go down for a back body drop, which is definitely not going to happen. And she just walloped me. So trust me, I took a couple shots from Mike Sharp, not potatoes, but he hit hard and it hurt. And yeah, so I was pretty much used to that.
You brought up the DVD, which I have in my collection. I watch it every so often, as a matter of fact. Just this past week, I was watching it again. Can you tell us how the DVD came to existence?
The whole purpose of me videoing this was to have it for myself, for posterity. That was it. What happened was a few years later, my cousin Mike Omansky, a prominent guy in the record industry and a big wrestling, huge wrestling guy, a wrestling historian that Dave Meltzer is very friendly with, and he relies on Mike Omansky for WWF stuff when he does obits on these guys. Mike was then working at with a company called DigiView. And what DigiView would do was buy up video, and then they'd repackage it. They put a nice package on it. Whatever was inside didn't matter. If it was a nice package. But the key was their number one vendor was Walmart. And at the time, although they don't have it anymore, Walmart had a dollar bin. And they would throw any crap in this dollar bin for a dollar, and people would buy it. So Mike goes, "Do you want to do this?" I said, "Of course, I'll do it." And I signed the contract. I got 2 cents per copy as a royalty. They sold 650,000 copies. I'd like to say I got the full 13,000, but I didn't, because DigiView eventually, I think, went out of business. They didn't pay at the end. And these things started flying off the rack everywhere, and that's how it happened. It was purely just by accident, and it turned out to be, from what I've been told, the biggest selling, the most copies of a wrestling DVD in history. Obviously not the biggest grossing, because they sold them for a dollar. But if that's true, that's quite amazing when you think of it.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by. I know that he has questions as well, so I'm going to pass things over to him for a bit.
Nice to chat with you. Okay.
Well, thank you, Sunday. Hello, Mr. McAbee.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Mr. McAbee, I saw your YouTube video entitled, of course, The Iron Sheik versus The Mighty McAbee Part 1. And what struck me about this video was when you made your entrance to the ring, you were wearing a resplendent white robe. In fact, the snow white color reminded me of the Coast Guard cutters I used to sail on when I was stationed at Governor's Island. My question is, are there any replicas of this robe that can be found on eBay with your autographs on them?
Well, I do have the robe because I did bring it out to show my family during the Jewish holidays because they'd never seen it. I have the robe, I have the belt, I have the spandex, which right now for me to get into it would be X-spandex, because it's not the same trim weight that the McAbee used to be. I will tell you, though, I was looking into setting up a site for Mighty McAbee stuff with maybe shirts or dolls or stuff, because I have a feeling with this ridiculous subcult that's out there, there's probably some people that would want some of the stuff.
Well, I was going to say a replica white robe, because I was going to say that's probably in your display case along with your fencing awards and trophies.
A lot of fencing awards, but the wrestling stuff we keep in a different room because I don't want my regular friends and family to see that. But do you know that there's talk about Maccabee Mania 3, the 20-year reunion?
Oh, wow.
This is true.
Hey, that'd be great. I mean,
I think,
personally, I'd like to see you go up against George the Animal Steele. Yes.
It's funny you say that, because George Steele was one of the guys I reached out to come to the first show. And at the time, or maybe it was the second show, and at the time he had become an agent for WWE. And he says, well, you're going to pay me this, and for that 8-day run I get paid this, I can't do it. So I actually did reach out to him. But from what I hear, George Steele's not doing very well right now. He's pretty sick, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But we're thinking of, there's some names out there. I became good friends with Kevin Sullivan, and Kevin Sullivan, the Taskmaster, said he'd be willing to go. I'm also good friends with Crowbar. Do you remember Crowbar from WCW?
Oh, yes.
He was on the second show as Dangerous Devin Storm, and he's in great shape, and he wants to go. But we have to find the right opponent for the McAbee, because after 20 years, we can't just have just any match.
Oh, yes. Wow, okay. Boy, well, I'll come up with several suggestions. But I would like to see you work with Kevin Sullivan, because Sign Guy and myself have worked with Kevin Sullivan out here in the Northwest. Well, mostly Sign Guy in the ring sense. I provide him with snacks and stuff.
I saw him yesterday. There was a huge wrestling convention in Monroe, New Jersey, and I went to see Sullivan and Crowbar, and a lot of guys were there. And I got to meet Shane Douglas for the first time, and I was quite impressed with what a decent guy he was.
Wow, all right, okay. Well, Mr. McAbee, would you classify the headgear you wore in your match with the Iron Sheik as a combination of lucha mask and fencing mask, a sort of hybrid?
I would say it's 100% lucha mask. It's 100%. The first one I had, I have a big nose. It was a little tight on my nose, so I actually had to cut the little piece of leather out so I could breathe. It was pure lucha mask. But I have to say that in order for me to get the victory over the Sheik, I tried to be as nice as possible. There was outside interference. His own guy hits him with the loaded arm thing. I hit him with the fencing mask. But it didn't matter. He was professional about it. But you know something? On that finishing move when I came off the second rope with the fencing mask, I'm not trained to do this and how to pull it and everything. And evidently I hit him a little too hard. Because when we got back to the dressing room, which was really the locker room at the Livingston, New Jersey High School gym, which is exactly the same place where Chris Christie announced his run for president, the same floor, Sheik was real. I thought he was going to kill me. Because he gets that look in his eyes where he's really angry and his eyeballs narrow and everything, and you really think he's going to take a shot at you. And the reason was I looked at the top of his head, and he had like a 2-inch bloody waffle that I left on his head from the fencing mask, which of course is made, as Mike McCall would say, out of steel. And he was not a happy Sheik that time, I will say that.
Wow, would you say that look that the Iron Sheik gave you was about the same as Iron Mike Tyson when he got into the ring and confronted Stone Cold Steve Austin?
I would say the Sheik was a little bit scarier because, although I do remember that look, Tyson was believable in that as well. But Sheik, he was a very good guy, and he was, to think that he let a nobody who wasn't in the business do what I did with him is really incredible because you pay them, it's a little bit sad. And if you saw them, you saw the documentary, The Sheik, did you see that? So I didn't really know. They asked me for some tapes and everything. I sent them what I had. I really didn't know where they were going with that. And when I watched it, actually, I was pretty sad also because they sort of portrayed, you know, his match with me, like, you know, that he had hit rock bottom. Not just me, but being on the independent circuit like that. But it so happened that my match was the one they showed. And there were times I felt a little bit guilty about it. But this is the way life goes. And he didn't have to do it if he didn't want to. And he was happy to get paid what he got paid, you know, because he needed the money. And at that stage of the game, it really didn't matter if he won or lost or whatever. It was purely a show. It wasn't on TV. It didn't matter.
Wow. Okay. All right. All right. Well, speaking of combination lucha and fencing masks, how is the current state of female lucha wrestling in the city of Haifa, Israel?
I don't know, but I'm going to be over there in March, and I would very much like to meet one of them and see, have them put me in a few head scissors or something. But I will say that Bill Goldberg very much, you know, he's about to be in this match with Lesnar, so he signed with WWE. But I had spoken to him because he really very badly wanted to go to Israel. He had never been there. And I'm in charge of the U.S. Maccabee team. I was trying to work something out with him. Not to wrestle with him, but just to have him part of the team. But I don't know if that's going to play out at all, but I had been in touch with him. Is it fair to say that Goldberg is the second most famous pro wrestler after the Mighty Maccabee?
Well, I would certainly almost agree with that, yes. It depends on how much I would have been drinking.
I will say this. My kids, you know, were very young when they did this, and they didn't really realize how ridiculous it was at the time. We were just having fun. But I think as the years went by, you know, they sort of looked at it and said, how on earth did we ever get involved with that? It was a pretty ridiculous thing, and it is somewhat hard to believe it's 20 years ago. You know, it's a lot of the guys from these shows have passed away. Bam Bam Bigelow's gone. Blassie's gone. Mike Sharp so sadly died a few months ago. Kowalski's gone. Cheetah Kid, who was Flyboy Rocco Rock, he's gone. Cicluna, he didn't come, but he's gone. It is pretty sad how a lot of these guys left. I don't want to besmirch someone who's gone. But I will say one of the rougher times I had at the second show, everyone was very nice, and Bam Bam Bigelow was the only guy that gave me a little bit of trouble. Everyone else just dealt with whatever was being thrown at them, and for some reason, he maybe was in a bad mood that day. He gave me a rough time.
Oh, wow, Bam Bam Bigelow. Ooh, okay. Ooh, boy. Oh, boy. All right. Well, Mr. Maccabee, the triplane was a feared weapon in World War I. It had a set of three wings. It's also rumored that the step stool that Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over and started the Great Chicago Fire was a step stool with three legs. And in the 70s, the TV show Charlie's Angels had three beautiful ladies fighting crime. My question is, the triad is a symbol of strength. How much did your confidence rise after one of the Sheik's triad pieces, Ali Ben Shor, was removed from ringside and banished to the locker room?
I felt very good. Actually, when it comes to the triad, Maccabee Mania 3 will be the final piece of this step stool. Very funny story about Ali Ben Shor. He was a friend of mine, Jordy George, who I worked in the same place with. And the word schnorr in Yiddish is someone who's always mooching, getting stuff for free.
Oh.
So, we used to make jokes about Jordy. That was him. So that's how the name Ali Ben Shor came to be.
Oh, okay. I was pronouncing it wrong.
You had it right. You got it right on the nose. You got it.
Oh, okay. Now, were you confident that one of the world's strongest men, Ken Patera, could neutralize one of the remaining sides of the power triangle, Iron Mike Sharp?
I definitely felt he could. I felt very confident about that. I also felt that when I got gassed, which was after every 30 seconds, I could go over and talk to him and get my breath back. At the first Maccabee Mania in the tag team match, I got gassed so fast, I got blown up. They were running me around and clobbering me and everything. I could not breathe. Literally, I could not breathe. So finally, I make the alleged hot tag to Patera after like getting beaten up for 8 minutes. He goes in and does about 15 seconds worth of stuff with Sheik and Sharp. This is 1993, and I'm just barely pulling myself up by the ropes. Now I know what these wrestlers say about getting blown up, like Ultimate Warrior. By the time he got to the ring, I couldn't breathe. So after 15 seconds of making the hot tag, Patera comes over to me and tags me back in. I said, are you kidding me? So I give these wrestlers a lot of credit that they can go and go and go and not get blown up. It's pretty impressive.
Wow, yes. Yes, it does take a lot of cardiovascular fitness. Yes, very much. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm saying when I was a lower-level world-class fencer, I was in very, very good shape. But by this stage of the game, I was not a world-class fencer. I wasn't competing. I was basically playing golf. So wrestling shape is a very different type of shape. I will say that.
Yes. Well, Mr. Maccabee, I was amazed at your fast recovery from the Sheik's vicious use of a foreign object that he had hidden in his trunks. He hit you in the throat with this, and before the referee could determine what this foreign object was, he had passed it on to Iron Mike Sharp outside the ring. My question is, do you think you would have survived had the Sheik pulled out a cucumber from his trunks that had been made rock hard by dipping it in liquid nitrogen?
I don't think I would have survived the liquid nitrogen cucumber for sure. Lord knows if the Sheik tried to make me humble with it, that's for sure.
All right, how about a gherkin pickle?
Maybe that, but not the cucumber.
Oh, okay. All right, well, after a boot to the face, you survived a camel clutch from the Iron Sheik from the 620 mark to the 645 mark, a total of 25 seconds. My question is, how could you survive 25 seconds of the camel clutch when more seasoned wrestlers could not?
Well, it's very obvious. I mean, the Sheik had it cinched in, but the Mighty Maccabee is a Jewish superpower, and he was not about to give it up. There's no way he was going to get He had the entire Jewish people behind him, the state of Israel behind him. He waited 4 long years for his opportunity, and he wasn't about to give up to the Iron Sheik, no matter how that. He might have gotten that from Bob Backlund, but he wasn't going to get it from me.
Oh, wow. All right. Very good. Very good on that. All right. Well, you had the Iron Sheik in a sleeper hold and were on the verge of victory when Iron Mike Sharp interfered with a steel chair blow to your back. My question is, has this steel chair been inducted into the Wrestling Hall of Fame?
It really should have been. I really should be. And I'm going to speak to Dave Meltzer personally about having that in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. I think it should be. It should be. As well as Mike Sharp's arm brace and the Sheik's loaded boot.
Ah, yes, a loaded boot. Yes. Yes. All right. Well, you mentioned at an early age the Sunnyside Queens show. How long did you grow up in Queens? And did you ever see Johnny Ramone of the Ramones in Queens? His real-life name was John Cummings.
I did not, but I'm pretty sure that the Ramones came from the same high school. I was at Forest Hills High School, as did Simon and Garfunkel. I'm almost 100% sure that we went to the same high school.
Well, you should Wikipedia that. Where did John Cummings go to high school? You'll get your answer.
I'm pretty sure the Ramones were Forest Hills High School.
All right. All right, well, how about Gene Simmons of KISS, who did some growing up in Queens? He also worked a summer camp in the Catskills shortly after high school.
What, you know what camp?
No, I don't, but I do have his autobiography, and I'll try to get back with you on that. He had a job as a swimming instructor.
And I know he was into deli meat. You know what his favorite deli meat was?
Oh, wow, he did. That was his first job he ever had. I'm going to say pastrami.
No, if it's Gene Simmons, it had to be tongue.
Oh, tongue. Wow. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he does have a long tongue, yes. Okay. All right. Will, did you ever see the New York Dolls concerts with lead singer David Johansen and guitarist Johnny Thunders?
Nope, it really wasn't my shtick. I was into the Rangers, I was into all sorts of sports. I wasn't a big concert guy, to be candid with you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
But well, I can tell you that I did see very many times and root for him very hard Chris Jericho's dad, Ted Irvine, play. He was number 27 for the Rangers, the left wing. So I do remember him very well.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, Mr. Maccabee, boxing has produced a long line of Jewish boxing champions, among them Abe Atoll, who was called the Little Hebrew. He was U.S. World Featherweight Champ and also inducted into the Hall of Fame. You had Max Baer, U.S. World Heavyweight Champ in 1934 and 1935, who wore the Star of David on his trunks, and one of my favorite fighters of all time, Benny Leonard. He was a lightweight champ. Some people have called him the Ghetto Wizard. He also made the Hall of Fame and had an ungodly record of, I think it was 97 wins and only 5 losses, Benny Leonard. Do you know the current state of Jewish fighters boxing currently in the United States?
It's not what it used to be. I know, I can't think of the name right now, but I know there's a guy out of Brooklyn that's very prominent box at the Garden or whatever, but I just can't remember his name. But no, it's a different world than it used to be. It was sort of ironic because people don't think of Jewish people as fighters, but back in that era, the Jewish boxers were prominent in the sport, no question about it.
Oh, hell, they even had Robert Cohen, who was the world bantamweight champs. The Jewish people are very tough and resilient. Yes,
they got to be, yep.
Now, speaking of which, have you ever considered going to the former sites of the German concentration camps, Treblinka, Auschwitz, or Belsen, to put on a charity event?
Well, I mean, that's, of course, not going to happen. But my mom Alice, who's 92, is a Holocaust survivor. And I have gone back to Germany many times. And last year in Berlin, or Berlin as they say, we had the European Maccabi Games, and I was part of the team there. And we did go to a concentration camp. And when you go into this, you can't quite believe what happened. And it's hard to believe that any people could do this to other people. And you walk out of there saying it's simply unbelievable. And when you look at Holocaust survivors, it's hard to believe that they can make it through that. And my mom never talked about it. So there's two types of Holocaust survivors: those that keep throwing it at their kids to make sure it never happens again, and those who don't want to talk about it. My mom was one of those. And one time I asked her about it, and she goes, "Well, what happened to me when I was 20 years old is I lost 75 members of my family. I lost both of my parents, 20 years old. My life would never be the same. And I just said that they might have ruined my family life as I knew it, but they would never ruin my life. And my revenge on those Nazis that did this would be to live my life to the fullest." And my mom at 92, with macular degeneration and everything, still does something every day, whether it's seeing a movie or playing cards or going swimming. So it's really an amazing thing that people can make it through that, and how they make it through that.
Wow. And surprisingly enough, Jean Simmons' mother was a concentration camp survivor. She's Hungarian.
My mom is Czech. It was on the Hungarian border. Same type of thing. And I think it's best that we talk about more pleasant stuff like Maccabiah Mania 3. That'll be my revenge on those people.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. here's a more enlightening question. Are there any plans in your future to recreate the scene at Katz's Deli in New York with the movie Harry Met Sally, where you recreate the scene with Ric Flair? There's rumors out there.
Well, I have been to Katz's Deli. You know, a lot of the delis in New York are closing, including the Carnegie Deli is closing. And Katz's Deli is one of the last of the Mohicans. Although Ric Flair might be an interesting opponent for Maccabiah Mania 3, although I think he might be a little bit past his prime.
Oh, I don't know about Rick. I hear Rick keeps himself in pretty good shape. I pay big money to see a Mr. Maccabee Ric Flair match.
I think he does keep himself in great shape. And one of his greatest opponents is Ricky Steamboat. I saw him yesterday at that convention. Except for the gray hair, which, you know, wrestling is a looks business, a cosmetic business. Except for the gray hair, I think if you put Ricky Steamboat in the ring right now, looks-wise, he looks like a god. It's really quite amazing. A lot of the guys didn't, but he looked great.
Oh, yes, Ricky Steamboat has aged very gracefully. He's a graceful dragon. Yes.
As well as Tito Santana was there, who was one of the guys from that era, and who was very close to me. He looks like he's 45, 50 years old, not 60 or whatever he is. It's amazing. Some of these guys who led a cleaner life, you know, it was very interesting. I was talking to Kevin Sullivan and Shane Douglas. We had a good time. Boy, I was in Mark Heaven yesterday, that's for sure. And I said, guys, I want to ask you a question. Half of your friends are dead. They died in their 40s. You are alive. How did that happen? And Shane Douglas looked at me and goes, luck. He goes, you know, everyone did the same stuff. You know, we all lived a crazy lifestyle and everything like that. Those of us that lived, a little bit of it was luck. Pretty amazing.
Yes, Jesse Ventura was fond of saying Chico Santana. Yes. Jesse was also. Speaking of, have you ever met Jesse Ventura?
Well, I forgot. I forgot about this. Well, what happened at MSG at the Madison Square Garden shows, they would usually, the last match would be a match that was completely insignificant, like Chief J. Strongbow against Professor Tanaka, that would go a 20-minute draw. So I never stayed for that show. I wanted to go home. One time I leave the Garden on 8th Avenue, I get into my car, Jesse Ventura is walking on the street. And I go, hey, Jesse, why don't you need a ride? He goes, yeah, I'm going uptown to the Howard Johnson. They used to stay at 50th and 8th at the Howard Johnson. I said, I'll give you a ride. So, again, more Mark Heaven. So, you know, I was talking to him, and I said, you know, I've never seen anyone that's so natural on the microphone as you. You're really just terrific, because you know there's a crappy wrestler. And he goes, yeah, that's one thing that always came, talking is easy for me. And I just never forget those 10 minutes with Jesse Ventura. That was the one thing that stood out, was talking is easy for me, which is all he did in wrestling. And then when he became the governor of Minnesota, same thing. Jesse's a little bit off the rails now, in my opinion, but boy, he was quite a character.
Well, another guy that was very good on the microphone was Gordon Solie.
Gordon Solie was terrific, and I was a very ballsy guy. You know, I did a lot of stuff in life, and when I went down to Atlanta for a fencing tournament, I fenced one particular weapon, and I told the organizers, you have to have my event on Sunday, because I wanted to be able to go to the TV tapings on Saturday morning with my friend, and he did it. And I contacted Gordon Solie one time. I had met him in Florida when he got me first row tickets to the Fort Homer Hesterly Armory. I'll tell you another story about that in a second. So Gordon Solie has me and my two friends. We were Olympic hopefuls. And during the show, he mentions our names in the Atlanta Sport the studio there. And they actually had the camera with like a little circle on a picture of the three of us. The whole thing was ridiculous because we were nobodies, but I mentioned Gordon Solie. Another time, down at the Sportatorium in Tampa, when I go to visit my uncle, I would make sure to go to one of the shows, and I go on the Thursday afternoon to the TV taping there. And I told Gordon Solie I'm coming. He goes, okay, I have a special seat for you. He didn't even know me. I never met him. And he had me in a folding chair right next to the heel dressing room there. And these heels are coming out one after another. I'm just sitting there, and they're looking at me going, who the hell is this? But the one thing I remember is from that TV taping, they were holding up the taping as long as they could because Abdullah the Butcher was in a huge match, and he had to do his promos and everything, and his plane was late. Finally, he shows up with his manager, Jimmy Holiday, some guy I really didn't know who that. I wasn't familiar with him. So Abdullah comes out. He's literally 10 feet in front of me. I'm not on camera, but he's 10 feet away from me. And he's doing his promo in front of the ring with Gordon Solie, and every time he breathed, a 6-inch boogie was going out of his nose and into his nose, out of his nose into his nose. It was, and this is on YouTube. So if you could, you can actually find that on YouTube. So I sort of became It was funny. I sort of became friendly with Gordon Solie. I don't think I even ever met him. It was on the telephone, or maybe I wrote him a letter or something. One day, I get a call from his son-in-law, who was involved with writing his book after Gordon had passed away. And he said that he had found some letters back and forth with me and Gordon or whatever, and he wanted to talk about me in the book. I said, you got to be kidding me. You're having this phone call with me. I have no connection to the wrestling business, but when I look at some of the stories that I've been through, it's quite amazing for someone not in the business that I did have some interesting times.
Yeah, boy. All right, well, Mr. McAbee, it's been a very good pleasure talking with you. And at this point, I'm going to pass it back over to Sign Guy. And good luck in your Johnny Ramone, did you go to the same high school search? Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, QT. Well, Jeff, we got just a few minutes left in the show. I want to give that time to you. If there's anything you'd like to say to the listeners, plug and promote absolutely anything at all that you would like, floor is all yours.
Well, I would say that I had a great time in the wrestling world. I had a great time in the fencing world where I was Olympic team captain in 2004, 2008. In 2012 for London and this past year Rio, I worked for NBC as the fencing color analyst, which is quite ridiculous in its own right. I was a two-time Olympic referee, so I've had quite a good run in the world of fencing. I had quite a good run in the world of wrestling. But all seriousness, I really hadn't thought about it until this recent cult thing came up. But I think we're looking at doing a Maccabee Mania 3 sometime in mid-2017 or early 2017. We're probably going to put up a website, and we're going to have to figure out who the right opponent's going to be for the mighty Maccabee returning after a 20-year absence. And I thank you for having me on. And that's pretty much all I have to say. And again, thanks very much for having me on.
It's been our great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a blast having you on the show. Hopefully we'll get to do it again as we get ready for Maccabee Mania number 3.
Thanks a lot, guys, and hang in there with that weather.
Will do. Thank you very much. Fans, if you've not seen it, you definitely owe it to yourself. Find footage of the Maccabee Mania shows 1 and 2. I was always entertained by them. Definitely check those out. And make plans as soon as you hear where and when Maccabee Mania number 3 is going to hit. We will be back with you next week. Next Sunday afternoon, we have Gene Lidgen on the show, so it should be outstanding. We'll talk to you then.
So long, guys.